Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Love, Janessa, a brand new true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts. It's a story about love, deceit and survival. And it's available now. Find out more at the end of this podcast.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 31st of January, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State has warned Israel that its long-term security will be at risk if it abandons efforts to resolve the conflict with the Palestinians. Lawyers for the former Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, say he has applied for a visa which would allow him to stay in the United States for another 6 months. Poland has announced a major boost in defence spending prompted by the war in neighbouring Ukraine. Also in this podcast,
chances are you've heard about the plane with a spiral staircase in first class. The plane with the two wide aisles and the three widescreen movies.
Remembering the Queen of the Skies in her prime, now the last Boeing 747 jumbo jet has rolled off the production line in the United States. We begin in the Middle East. Behind the deadly violence that's seen both Israelis and Palestinians die in recent days lies a greater problem. The long, seemingly fruitless peace process between the two sides. Well, on Monday, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, addressed that broader issue when he held a joint news conference with the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, in Jerusalem. He said Israel would endanger its own long-term security if it abandons efforts to resolve the escalating conflict with the Palestinians.
As we advance Israel's integration, we can do so in ways that improve the daily lives of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And that's crucial to moving toward our enduring goal of Palestinians and Israelis enjoying equal measures of freedom, security, opportunity, justice, and dignity. President Biden remains fully committed to that goal. We continue to believe that the best way to achieve it is through preserving and then realizing the vision of two states.
Mr. Netanyahu insisted he wanted a workable solution with Israel's Palestinian neighbours. He said he wanted to expand the circle of peace following the normalisation of relations with the UAE and Bahrain in 2020, known as the Abraham Accords.
We intend to deepen the peace that we've already made in the Abraham Accords. We discussed some of the initiatives that we are considering doing together, but also to perhaps achieve dramatic breakthroughs that I think could be both historic and enormously significant in our common efforts to bring prosperity, security, and peace to this part of the world and beyond. So with this in mind, I have to tell you that I also believe that expanding the circle of peace, working to close finally the file of the Arab-Israeli conflict, I think would also help us achieve a workable solution with our Palestinian neighbors.
Anna Foster is our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, and she told me more about what Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Blinken had to say.
To listen to it, you would think that they were singing from the same hymn sheet because they talked very warmly, very cordially about peace. But the details were very, very different. Antony Blinken talking specifically about a two-state solution, about equal measures for Israelis and Palestinians. But in fact, the wording that Benjamin Netanyahu used, he didn't talk about a two-state solution at all. He talked about a workable solution with our Palestinian neighbours. And of course, this needs to be taken in the context of the new, I say new, it's about a month old now, very right-wing government that Israel has, the most right-wing in its history. And that is because in order to form a coalition and to become prime minister once again, Benjamin Netanyahu needed to bring into his fold some of the most extreme right-wing elements of Israeli politics, ultra-nationalists who will not in any way entertain the idea of a two-state solution. They are the people who are keeping him in power and keeping him in the government at the moment. So he needs to tread a very fine line, of course, between keeping the US happy, a key ally to Israel, but also keeping his coalition partners happy as well.
Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Mr. Blinken goes on to the Palestinian territories. He'll be meeting the Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas. What can we expect Mr. Blinken to say to him, do you think?
I think that there's every chance that he will suggest that elections are held. They haven't been held in the occupied Palestinian territories for a very long time. Mahmoud Abbas has been in power as a Palestinian president for a very long time. And particularly younger Palestinians, many of them feel now that the Palestinian Authority is no longer fit for purpose, that it's not representing them, that it's not serving their needs. And that is why you see in parts of the West Bank now, in certain towns, the PA really losing control because they're not seen as a strong force anymore, quite frankly. So I think there's every chance that Antony Blinken will talk about the future, about what should happen to try and bring issues there under control as well. I think he might also suggest that the Palestinians resume security cooperation with Israel. It's such a vital part of the way that things are run here, for right or for wrong. People have different opinions on it, but it is part of the way that things are run. And after the IDF raid in Jenin last week, the Palestinians immediately froze that security cooperation. And remember, Antony Blinken, one of his key statements before he arrived here, the US State Department were very clear about this, that de-escalation and trying to restore some kind of calm was right at the top of the agenda. And I think if that is going to happen, then security cooperation between Israel and the Palestinians would probably need to be restarted. So I imagine that is a conversation that he'll be having as well.
That was Anna Foster. The authorities in Pakistan now say that nearly 60 people were killed and more than 150 injured in an attack at a mosque. The blast took place during Monday afternoon worship in Peshawar. Pakistani officials have said the attack was a suicide bombing, which appears to have been aimed at a large number of police officers who were praying at the mosque. An inquiry is underway into how the suicide bomber accessed the compound. Pakistan's Prime Minister, Shehbaz Sharif, visited the city's main hospital. As evening fell, a mass funeral was held for some of the victims, their coffins draped in flags. A salute was played in their honour. Our correspondent Caroline Davies visited the scene of the explosion and sent this report.
Torn apart, the entire back wall of the mosque caved in. Piled up plaster, wood, pillars collapsed on many of those who had come to pray. Some survivors pulled themselves from the rubble. Rescue workers spent hours trying to find those trapped underneath, some shifting the debris with their bare hands. Ambulances have spent the day bringing survivors and the dead to Peshawar's Lady Reading Hospital. The wards are full of the injured. Some are still in their police uniform. Waiting in a corridor, we found Zahib Nawaz, his arm in a plaster cast and his back injured. He told us that he remembers a white flash and was blown 5 or 6 feet back by the force of the blast. Then the rubble fell on him. He spent more than an hour trapped beneath it. Mohammed Hassan was a doctor on duty.
There were multiple type of injuries. Many patients were having skull trauma, extradural hematomas, subdural hematomas, depressed skull fractures, and they were having multiple wounds with pellets inside them.
Since the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in 2021, Pakistan has seen an increase in the number of violent attacks. The country's army had claimed it had broken the group's capabilities, but this latest explosion and the damage it has caused will make many fearful that more attacks are to come.
Caroline Davis. Lawyers representing Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, say that he's applied for a tourist visa, which would allow him to remain in the United States for another 6 months. Mr. Bolsonaro left Brazil the day before his term ended in December. He denies encouraging his supporters to storm Congress in Brasilia earlier this month. Gary O'Donoghue reports from Washington.
Ever since the turn of the year, Jair Bolsonaro has been holed up in the house of an MMA fighter in a gated community in central Florida. He entered the US on a visa reserved for diplomats and heads of state, but that only lasts 30 days, and Mr. Bolsonaro wants to stay longer. A group of congressional Democrats has already demanded the revocation of Mr. Bolsonaro's visa, arguing he should return to Brazil to cooperate with the investigation into the riots.
Gary O'Donoghue. Poland has announced it is sharply increasing its defence budget to 4% of GDP because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Here's our Europe editor, Paul Moss.
It is very much a frontline state these days. Poland has a long border with Ukraine and a long history of being invaded by Russia. So no surprise it plans to increase its defence budget. But the Polish Prime Minister is promising it'll go up by something like a third and in just a year. It would be no small task for any military to manage efficiently this much rapid extra spending. That said, Poland's promising to give tanks and other military equipment to Ukraine. In order to maintain stock levels, it may now go on a weapons shopping spree.
Paul Moss. Russia has accused the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson of lying. That's after he claimed that the Russian President, Vladimir Putin, threatened him personally with a missile strike. Mr. Johnson says President Putin told him it would take only a minute during a phone call before the invasion of Ukraine last February. The claims are made in a new BBC documentary, but as our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports, Moscow has a different version of events.
The Kremlin was categorical in its denial of Boris Johnson's dramatic claim that Vladimir Putin had threatened him with a missile strike. President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said this: "It's not true, or to be more accurate, it's a lie. Either a deliberate falsehood," he continued, "or an accidental one, from not understanding what the president was saying." Mr. Peskov insisted there had been no threats to use missiles, and that the Kremlin leader had simply pointed out that if Ukraine joined NATO, the potential deployment of NATO or US missiles near Russia's border would mean that any missile could reach Moscow within minutes. A firm denial, then. But that doesn't alter the fact that in recent months, the Kremlin has been engaged in nuclear saber-rattling. After ordering the invasion of Ukraine, President Putin warned countries that may try to interfere that Russia's response would be immediate and lead to consequences never seen before in history.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. In Britain, the UK Ministry of Defence has said that schooling in Russia is becoming increasingly militarised. Razia Iqbal spoke to a man who teaches college students, young teenagers, in a city in the region of Kursk on the border with Ukraine. His name is Nikita, and we're only using his first name for his own safety. He was first asked how schools have changed since the beginning of the invasion of Ukraine.
Things really got different. We got a lot more propaganda. Even before war, we had almost nothing that could be called propaganda. But from starting of war, we got some lessons. It's just like normal classes, but we had to talk about war. We had to talk about things that Russian soldiers doing in Ukraine. And of course, we told to talk in good manner about Russian soldiers. Of course, I did not told in that manner. Actually, I chosen another theme. In some places, you can do that, and actually nothing bad will happen with you. But in some cases, you will be maybe fired, maybe you'll be arrested.
You're also using the word war, which is not usual inside Russia. We understand that it's against the law to use the word war, and it's supposed to be called a special operation. Is that how it's being talked about inside the schools?
Actually, when it comes to official speech, almost everyone, at least to the administration of educational places, of schools and colleges, are saying special military operation. But when it comes to normal talks between people, everyone and even teachers are telling war, and there's nothing so bad about it.
We are hearing from the British intelligence that President Putin is going to bring back mandatory military training to Russian schools for the first time in several decades. How do you think that's going to manifest itself? What is it? What kinds of military training are people in schools going to be given?
Actually, I feel skeptical about this, because when it comes to making some structure to do this. I think that Putin's Russia is not good in forming these sort of structures.
When you say you're sceptical, you don't think that it will happen inside schools, that students will be given training into how to handle grenades, how to handle Kalashnikovs. You don't think that's going to happen?
Even if it would happen, it surely won't be any close to things that declared. There are some centers of military education that actually made a few years ago, and in last year, autumn of 2022, they actually came to work. This center should provide some military education for students and pupils from Russian education. But what actually happened, and there were my students that came to these centers, they came there for 5 days, so they had sleep there, eat there, do some physical exercises, almost no things that could be actually called something militaristic.
That was Nikita, a Russian teacher in the region of Kursk near Ukraine. Now, for aviators around the world and those who love to travel, it really is the end of the runway now for one of the most famous aeroplanes ever built. On Tuesday, the last commercial Boeing 747 will be delivered to Atlas Air in the United States for use as a cargo plane as airlines switch to more efficient models. Oliver Burlow looks back on the life of the original jumbo jet and his first memory of getting on board.
It is probably the most easily recognisable passenger plane in the world.
Chances are you've heard about the plane with the spiral staircase in first class. The plane with the two wide aisles and the three widescreen movies and the 8-foot ceilings and economy. And chances are you've wondered, who's going to get this incredible bird off the ground?
In case you wonder, the answer to the question in this advertisement is Pan Am, the first airline to fly the 747 back in 1969. The unique streamlined design with its hump to accommodate a second deck set it apart from other passenger aircraft. Known as the Queen of the Skies, the 747 became a symbol of passenger air travel for the rich and the not-so-rich alike, at the time when passenger numbers on transatlantic flights had just overtaken crossings by boat. The Boeing 747 met the demand for mass air travel as flying became more affordable. My own first experience of it came half a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when I, together with 14 other young journalists from behind the Iron Curtain, was invited to spend 3 months in New York. It was at Frankfurt Airport that I caught my first glimpse of the white and blue airliner with its Pan Am logo, and I couldn't believe my luck. My only experience of air travel up to that point had been a Soviet IL-62, and the contrast was as stark as one would expect of communist versus capitalist travel experience. Glamour, style and comfort, that was my impression of the aircraft. More than 1,500 Boeing 747s were built for dozens of airlines around the world. A few of the big airlines are still flying it today, but it will slowly and inevitably disappear from the skies as more modern, less fuel-guzzling planes replace it. But there was something special about the original jumbo jet, and many will miss it.
Oliver Burlow there. Still to come. Noise pollution in general has become a big problem in large parts of China. We found out later what the government's solution is. The Red Cross Federation has described COVID-19 as the biggest disaster in living memory. In its annual report, it warned that countries were still dangerously unprepared for future pandemics. The organisation's Secretary General is Jagan Chapagain.
I think no other disasters, the hurricane, earthquake, drought or flood, can compete in terms of the terrible human and socioeconomic cost. Of course, the most conservative estimates tell us that 6.5 million people died from COVID-19 across these 3 years. But we all know that the real number could be much, much higher.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has warned that COVID-19 remains a global emergency. It says it's too early to lift the highest level of alert, which it declared 3 years ago. Naomi Grimley reports.
With COVID infections still ripping through Chinese cities, it was very unlikely that the WHO was going to declare the public health emergency over during this latest review. But it does say the pandemic is nearing a transition point and that higher population immunity through vaccination and infection is limiting the impact of COVID on mortality rates. It also confirmed that more than 13 billion doses of vaccines had now been administered.
Naomi Grimley, how loud do you listen to your music? Do you turn the volume up to 11? Well, a new study has found that more than 1.4 billion young people are at risk of hearing loss because they've got the volume turned up too loud. One former DJ suffered profound hearing loss and tinnitus, which is a permanent ringing in the ears.
My name's Simon Baker. I'm a craniosacral therapist from London. Worked in the music industry for 15, 20 years. I can remember people used to walk into the DJ booth and be like, you know, why are they so loud? And I just felt that that was the way that I was connecting with the music, I guess. I tried using ear protection, like molded earplugs that help DJs still hear the music, but they cut out certain frequencies, and I tried using them and I just felt really disconnected from the music and disconnected from the crowd. So I tended not to use them, and I guess really by doing that my tinnitus probably got worse, and I eventually went for some hearing tests and I was told that I'd lost some top end frequencies. If I could go back, I would certainly change and realize it, not everything needs to be hammering the levels in order to hear music properly.
A sanitary tale there. Well, James Reynolds spoke to Crystal Rolfe, Director for Health at the Royal National Institute for the Deaf and a trained audiologist. He asked her, how dangerous is it to listen to loud music for a long time?
Yeah, it's quite a wake-up call, isn't it, really, listening to that story. So we know that lots of people are listening to sounds really loud and not realising how much damage they're doing to their ears. And so it's about how loud you listen for and also how long you listen for. But the good news is, like, it's totally preventable. You can really enjoy listening to all of the music that you like to listen to while still protecting your hearing. And if anybody's concerned about their hearing and not sure whether they've already done damage to it, RNID have got a free hearing check at rnid.org.uk where you can check out if you've already damaged your hearing at all and things that can help.
What's the worst device? What's the most risky device? Are the big headphones we see people wearing? Are they the smaller pod headphones? Is it standing really on the front row of a loud gig?
So the answer is all those things can damage your hearing. So anytime you've got music turned up loud for too long, you can permanently damage your hearing. So you might be somewhere with background noise and you're tempted to turn the volume up and don't realise that you're doing it. You might be stood in front of a speaker, in which case kind of take some breaks from listening to the loud sound. And if you've got headphones on, use the inbuilt safety features that you've got in your phone. So iPhones are sold with a kind of built-in volume limit, and Android phones have got kind of a prompt when you're raising the volume too loud. So there isn't one device, but there's lots of different ways that you can damage your hearing. But there are lots of ways that you can enjoy listening to music while still protecting your ears.
That was Crystal Rolfe from the RNID. Staying with the issues of noise, let's go to the streets of Shenzhen in China. Quite an earful, isn't it? Well, noise pollution like that in general has become a real problem in large parts of China. So what's the government's solution? Well, a ban on honking on city roads or streets, unless that is you're approaching sharp turns, overtaking another vehicle, or you are in an emergency. Kerry Allen, our China media analyst, told me more about why people at the moment use their horns so much.
It's just been the case for a lot of people driving for a long period of time to honk their horns practically every 5 seconds just to make you aware that they're on the road. I mean, China's roads in urban areas can be quite dangerous anyway, but when I was living in China 10 years ago, it was very common to hear that background noise. And the idea that Shenzhen, a major city, would put a halt to this, not just at night hours, but throughout the day as a whole is a big change.
How are people going to manage? Because from what you're saying, it seems almost like a nervous tick that people have when they're driving. It's going to be really difficult to re-educate themselves to not do this.
It really is. And that's been one of the big talking points on Sina Weibo, which is China's equivalent of Facebook or Twitter. People have been saying that actually they think it could result in more accidents, with people suddenly on a reflex wanting to reach out and press their horn and realising that this could result in a penalty.
And what kind of penalties are possibly going to be imposed?
Well, it's not been made clear yet what's going to be imposed in Shenzhen, but one newspaper, China Daily, has said that some cities like Jinan and Chengdu have already banned honking in some downtown areas. And the fines have been between $3 and $30.
And noise pollution in general across China, what kind of problems are there with that? Is it widespread in other areas as well?
It is a big problem, yes. So in 2021, over 450,000 complaints about China's environment. Of that, 45% were about noise disturbance. And there have been a lot for years, particularly related to square dancing, which is where elderly women gather in a square with a boombox. They play loud music and dance. And China has been trying to crack down on noise related to this. With the instance of square dancing, what I have seen is in some cities, big monitors set up that show how many decibels music is played at. And this is all related to China's five-year plan, where it's trying to tackle noise pollution and improve the country's acoustic environment.
Do you reckon this is coming from the government? You say there are a lot of complaints from individuals as well. Are people in China quite intolerant of noise around them?
I think it's very much coming from the government. I mean, I think back to when I was living in China, you more or less, you're used to it. It was one of the most bizarre things coming back to the UK and suddenly realising how quiet things were. But China does have big problems with insomnia. So honking at night can disrupt people's sleep. And there can be local incentives, local grants given to governments as a result of this. So it might potentially be a way of a local government being able to get more funding in the future.
That was our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. Now to New Zealand, and the retired rugby union player, Campbell Johnston, has become the first All Black to come out as gay. The prop forward said he hoped his decision to go public would be what he called the final piece of the puzzle in making sport in his country inclusive. More from our correspondent, Joe Wilson.
Campbell Johnston said he had a picture of an All Black in his mind growing up, manly, strong, and probably with a wife. Embodied by the ceremonial pre-match haka, that team, perhaps more than any other in sport, has symbolised a traditional image of uncompromising masculinity. Campbell Johnston's successful career as a prop forward included 3 matches for New Zealand. Yet through it all, he knew he was suppressing his sexuality. Now in his 40s, speaking on TV New Zealand, he came out publicly.
It's hard living a double life or living a lie. If I can be the first All Black that comes out as gay and take away the pressure, I guess, and the stigma surrounding that whole issue, then we can, you know, then it can actually help other people.
Rugby Union's governing body in New Zealand says Campbell Johnston's strength and visibility will pave the way for others. In London, a spokesperson for the world's first gay and inclusive rugby union team, the King's Cross Steelers, told me he welcomed a role model from the sport's pinnacle, but hopes players in the future can be open about their sexuality during their careers, not just afterwards.
That was Joe Wilson. She is the Queen of Clean, who tells people to spark joy by decluttering. But Marie Kondo has admitted that she's now kind of given up on tidying up. Charlotte Gallagher has more.
You guys know the name Marie Kondo? You are a phenomenon.
Her closet arranging lessons have become the Bible.
Marie Kondo has written multiple books, starred in her own television series, and even has a store dedicated to, you guessed it, cleaning. She also has multi-step folding procedures for clothing, so items sit neatly in drawers. Her method of organising is this. You gather your possessions together and only keep the things that spark joy. Everything else can go.
Hold each item and choose items that
spark joy for you.
Spark joy.
She says a process that can seem overwhelming becomes an invigorating pick-me-up. You discover what you love and what you need. But Marie Kondo isn't currently practicing what she preaches. Speaking to the Washington Post, she explained that since having her third child, her home is messy. And she's realised that what's important to her is enjoying spending time with her family at home. But what about her fans, people that threw out things that didn't spark joy? Well, it seems Kondo's confession has made her more relatable. And as one person wrote on Twitter, her version of messy, well, it's probably not like most people's.
Charlotte Gallagher there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Eleanor Bowles. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
When you meet someone online, can you trust they are who they say they are?
I keep thinking so much about you.
She's so stunning.
It's all well planned.
Love, Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
She was trying to get me to send her money.
And it's available now.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
Search for Love, Janessa wherever you found this podcast.